Okay. How to Catch a Falling Star, Poetry and the Spiritual Life. Thank you whoever gave me the first half of the title. It wasn't me. It's very nice. But I was talking to Neil before and we realised that it comes from a poem by John Donne about a series of things which are impossible. So the first half of the title comes from a poem about a series of things which are impossible. So I hope I'm not attempting the impossible tonight anyway, by talking about poetry and the spiritual life. Another thing, if you are nervous, if you don't know much about poetry or you haven't really ever looked into it, don't worry, I'm not here to tell you that you have to read poetry or anything like that. On the other hand, though, you might find it makes you curious or interested. And if you do like poetry, then of course, hopefully this is the night for you. Tonight we're going to look at how poetry can act as an inspiration in the spiritual life, an ally to all the other things we do, like meditation, obviously, reflection, study, communication, friendship, and so on, all those important things. I've always found poetry to be an ally on the spiritual path, and I know many others do. And I'll probably introduce a personal note at times about what poetry means to me in terms of my own spiritual life, or even just life. You'll have noticed when you come to the West London Buddhist Centre, or any FWO Buddhist Centre, or go on retreat, that there are a few people who introduce a bit of poetry into things. And they might read a poem before a puja or meditation or in the context of a talk. Or it might just pop out sometime. And Paramananda does a lot of that, and I always appreciate that. And it really works very well for me when he talks about when he reads poems, weaves poetry in. And whenever I do hear a poem, or whenever I hear a good poem, I'm immediately in the same world that the Dharma inhabits. That's how it feels to me. The same world as meditation, the same atmosphere, even sometimes a kind of archetypal world where the spiritual and the poetic meet. So I thought tonight, without over-examining things, we'd just have a look at why that might be, why perhaps poetry and the Dharma share an atmosphere. First of all, of course, I'm not the only person who thinks this way. It's important to say that. You'll probably realise that the arts in general are important in this movement, in the FWO. Our founder, Sangharakshita, is very keen on the alliance of art and the spiritual life, on the points where they cross over. And he has described the appreciation, and for those inclined that way, the practice of the arts, as one of the distinctive emphases of our movement, the FWO, alongside our commitment to friendship, team-based, right livelihood, and other important things. He's described six emphases of the FWO to distinguish it from other movements, and he says that arts, so the practice and enjoyment of the arts is one of our emphases. So yes, you'll find arts activities going on all over the movement as very much part of what we do. And I can talk a bit more specifically about the kind of poetry activities that happen later on. But Sangharakshita has written and taught on the subject of art and the spiritual life quite extensively. And obviously I'll be drawing on those teachings tonight. And I've also had some involvement myself in various poetry enterprises around the movement, as well as elsewhere. There's a book at the back that nobody ever buys or looks at, which I was trying to promote once. I was one of the managers of it. There we are, it's a little sad book at the back there. What is it called? The Heart is Origami. That's right. Yes. That was a fantastic book. There are two copies left, so if you did want to rush off and buy it at the end. I was the publicity manager. Actually, we did sell over 1,000 copies, which for a poetry book is pretty good going. Anyway, so that's So that's to set a bit of context for tonight's theme. And yes, Tarquin is holding up the very volume there. It's very rare now, actually. There's not many copies that are around. You might see it in rare bookshops along in Charing Cross Road and things like that. So that's a bit of context for tonight's theme. But just now to explain the format of the evening, the way I'm planning things. First I'm going to give this talk, which I'm giving now, and then about how poetry can link up with the spiritual life and the inspiration I take from it myself. And I'll be dropping a few poems and quotations as I go along. And then we'll look at a few poems together, I hope, and then see how they strike us and if we like them or not, and what we like in them. And finally, I'm hoping there'll be time for questions and a bit of general discussion. So that's an ambitious programme. See if we can get through. I haven't got all that. I know this looks like an incredibly thick part of notes here, but it's very big, typed out very big. So I haven't really got all that much to say. But first of all, a couple of definitions, probably in order. It's traditional in the FWO to have lots of definitions, but it is important. I've said tonight is about poetry and the spiritual life. So I'm throwing these terms around, poetry, spiritual life, and terms like Dharma. But what do I mean by them? There are all kinds of definitions of poetry. I like what Samuel Taylor Coleridge said, that prose is words in their best order. Poetry is the best words in the best order. And William Wordsworth, his friend of his, had a very high conception of the poet and of poetry, and felt that poetry was a description of the world filtered through the refined sensibility of a poet, thereby revealing the significance of the world. Famously, he also said, it was the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings. It takes its origin, he said, from emotion recollected in tranquility, until the original provoking emotion is accessed again by the poet and transmitted to the reader. I like Emily Dickinson's typically intense definition of poetry. If I read a book, she said, and it makes my whole body so cold, no fire can ever warm me, I know that is poetry. If I feel physically as if the top of my head were taken off, I know that is poetry. I think her definition describes best the sort of thing I'm thinking of when I say poetry. Not something merely ornamental or pretty or nice, but something that is beautiful, moving, sometimes exciting, takes you deeper into the heart of things, may be challenging, may even be terrifying sometimes in its beauty. And implied in that, perhaps, is my belief that all good poetry is true. Any really good poem, when you read it or hear it, will ring true. And for me, incidentally, some of the best prose can reach the status of poetry as well. When you're reading prose masters like Dickens, Melville, Virginia Woolf, or James Joyce, for me you are reading poetry. And what about the spiritual life? What do I mean by that? For me, that's an honest quest to find out what's true and live by that, put it into practice, or at least try to. It's the quest for truth, beauty, and connection with the world. It's a stepping beyond the self so that we can realise our solidarity, even our identity with each other and with all things. It's finding that authenticity, that contentment within, that comes with adopting a more expansive, a more real outlook. And it's all the tools I need to carry me on that quest. For me, having looked in a number of places for that sort of meaning in life, I found that Buddhism is the best context for it, makes the most sense. Buddhism, for me, is the best vehicle, the best raft to the other side, to use the Buddha's own expression. But I hope then that I'm a Buddhist because Buddhism makes sense in my experience, approaches truth, beauty and love better than other paths, not because I'm just attached to a set of beliefs and practices called Buddhism, if you see what I mean. The term Buddhism itself is actually only a Western term for what in the East is simply called the Dharma or the Way. And what's the Dharma or the Way? What do I mean by that? The Buddha's own answer to this was, whatever leads to calm, not distress, contentment, not greed and grasping, individuality, not group-mindedness. To energy, not idleness. He said anything of that nature is the Dharma, is his teaching. Anything that has that flavour, the flavour of freedom, if you like, is the Dharma. In Sangharakshita's words, the Dharma is whatever helps us to rise from wherever we are now and from whatever we are now. It's whatever the individual finds in his or her own experience does actually contribute to his or her spiritual development. And always remember that one definition of the Dharma is simply the truth, nothing more or less than that. So for me, poetry is something that can help me in all that, can help guide me, inspire me, educate me, form my heart towards the goal of the truth, and contributes towards my spiritual development. It helps to take me, if only temporarily, beyond the narrow confines of the ego, and helps me identify with the world more, not just myself. Helps me see the world as it really is, and all its humanity, its people, with love and compassion. Well, that's the ambition, anyway. The path Buddhism outlines, put in one way, is to indicate two great goals, or works in progress, if you like, wisdom and compassion. Wisdom is the kind of realizational part, compassion the active part, of one and the same thing. Wisdom is understanding the way things are, interconnected, though various, without anything we identify being ultimately real or lasting forever. And compassion is the response to that, to the implications of all that. That in the end, we ourselves are not self-enclosed identities separate from each other. We're all part of a whirl of conditions, of energies, a beautiful universe, no part of which is a centre or the most important part. Now for me, as I say, poetry does inspire me on this path. It can help take me along this path. It comes from the deepest inspiration, the meditation-like expansion of the mind that leads to an apprehension of truth, beauty and love. It is challenging because it can open up to me experiences beyond my own, allow me to glimpse greater dimensions of consciousness than I normally experience. In doing so, it can show me how much there is beyond the ego, the narrow ego that I cling to. Poetry and fiction and drama, when they explore character and the worlds of characters unfamiliar to me, can expand my sympathies and teach me more empathy and compassion. So now we can actually look at a poem. You'll be relieved to hear. So I've got this handout. There's going to be a certain logistic enterprise. There's only 16 handouts, so we probably need to share. Don't worry, I'm going to read it out. Jananda's going to get his glasses, but he'll catch up. So we can look at this poem, Archaic Torso of Apollo, which is by the Austrian poet Rilke. And he was born in 1875 and died in 1926. A really, truly great poet. Wrote in German, obviously. So this is translated from the German, Archaic Torso of Apollo. We cannot know his legendary head with eyes like ripening fruit, and yet his torso is still suffused with brilliance from inside, like a lamp, in which his gaze, now turned to low, gleams in all its power. Otherwise, the curved breast could not dazzle you so. Nor could a smile run through the placid hips and thighs to that dark centre where procreation flared. Otherwise this stone would seem defaced beneath the translucent cascade of the shoulders, and would not glisten like a wild beast's fur, would not, from all the borders of itself, burst like a star. For here there is no place that does not see you. You must change your life. So here's a poem that presents that aspect of great art and of the great poetry that I've been talking about. It beckons you to such great beauty, to such a more expansive way of being, beyond everything we've been used to, that it challenges you to change, to grow, to try and meet the greater world, or at least go some way towards it. It's as if this sculpture has been created with such power and vision that it actually embodies more of reality than we're used to. And the reality of this work of art is so great, so overpowering, Rilke says, that it's more as if it sees you than that you see it. Some great poets just have, naturally, a depth of soul that can expand our consciousness, lead us into uncharted experience. Others deliberately set out on that shaman-like task. Wordsworth saw this sort of thing as his mission, and specifically set it out as his life's task in his preface to Lyrical Ballads, which was an early volume of poetry that he wrote originally with Coleridge. It may be hard for us now to think of Wordsworth as a young radical, because he's kind of entered the canon as a kind of old, stuffy old man sort of thing, but that's what he was at one time. He was a radical, and he was radical and original and fresh as a poet. Later on, he did grow more cautious and conservative, and many people think his poetry declined at the same time. I don't know if the two are directly connected. And I love what the great and revolutionary French poet Rimbaud said, laying out a programme for himself. A poet makes himself a seer by means of a long, immense and systematised arrangement of all the senses. Rimbaud wanted to divest himself of all the given ideas in his life, the bourgeois view of the world he was brought up to have, and see the world afresh. But his approach to that was to drink an enormous amount and take huge amounts of absinthe, which is a kind of a drug, which was very popular in Paris and France in the 19th century, and also by pushing himself beyond ordinary moral boundaries, doing things like stabbing his friends and kind of thing. He was like a sort of 19th century Sid Vicious. But from all this kind of maelstrom of his life, a very adventurous life, he did manage to write some stunning poetry. But other poets have been less extreme, a little bit less extreme, while essentially trying to do the same thing. Trying to go deeper and further in their consciousness in order to be able to bring back for us the results of those psychic expeditions. Many poets say that there needs to be a lot of space around a poem, a lot of built-up contemplation. Then the poem might come out in one sort of hyper-conscious rush. I think of Wordsworth pacing up and down in his garden. Apparently that's how he used to compose. He used to walk a lot, and part of some of his walking was in his garden, just pacing up and down, and as he walked he thought of his poems. And a lot of people that say that explains the kind of rhythm of his poems, which is very, very rhythmic and very quiet, actually. He writes a very quiet poetry. Insightful, rhythmic, but quiet poetry. On the other hand, his friend Coleridge, who was a very different character, spent more time charging around over the moors and mountains and also taking lots of opium, which didn't detain us very long, but he did take an enormous amount of opium. And some people say, well, that was the origin of his visions, but other people say, well, he was a visionary to start with, and then he took opium to try and keep that going. But he did have an extremely powerful and visionary imagination, and some of his poetry looks like the result of some kind of shamanistic journey. And if, don't know if you know his poetry, but if you think of The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, one of the most famous English poems, it's full of extremely weird imagery. And Kubla Khan, is a visionary poem. But broadly, when you think of the deep places, the deep contemplation, conscious or unconscious, that the best poetry comes from, it's no wonder that sometimes it has that same feel of richness and depth and energy that meditation has. So I think it comes from the same place, that the places we go when we deeply meditate and when we produce, or when poets produce the great poems, I think they come from the same places. And some of it really does strike you as taking part in insight, I think, ringing true in the way I mentioned earlier. It's really as if the power of the poet's imagination, his contemplation, has taken him towards the same barer, truer view of the world as that which spiritual searchers aim for in their meditation and reflection. Seamus Heaney, for me, a great Irish poet, can sometimes approach to such insights, although interestingly enough he denies having any sort of religious or spiritual agenda at all. Although he did recently say that having reached the age of 60, he thought he could mention the word love. And the next poem is his, Postscript. Which is number two on your hymn sheets. Postscript. And sometime make the time to drive out west into County Clare along the flaggy shore in September or October, when the wind and the light are working off each other, so that the ocean on one side is wild with foam and glitter, and inland among stones the surface of a slate-grey lake is lit by the earth lightning of a flock of swans, their feathers ruffed and ruffling, white on white, their fully grown headstrong-looking heads tucked or cresting or busy underwater. Useless to think you'll park and capture it more thoroughly. You're neither here nor there, a hurry through which known and strange things pass, as big soft buffetings come at the car sideways and catch the heart off guard and blow it open. So I really like that poem. There's something in it for me about the mixed, sort of interrelated and mutually affecting energies of nature, and then moving from there into the observer and showing the observer as a hurry through which known and strange things pass. I mean, I can identify myself in that, the hurry through which known and strange things pass. And then in the last line, he blows open any distinction between the interior and the exterior, when the big soft buffetings catch the heart off guard and blow it open. I think it often is at moments when we're off guard and we're deeply affected by something that the heart is blown open. And he's got something we all try and do, is the character in the poem is trying to capture what he's experiencing. It does happen. You're there in kind of, I don't know, Australia or something, you're trying to capture it on a camera. It's just impossible. Anyone else? Did anyone else enjoy that poem? Any thoughts? You don't have to say anything.
The image was very effective. I mean, you did actually get a real impression of the light on the water,
yeah,
and the lake, and particularly the swans. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, if language very effectively producing a mental image.
Yeah. Someone over there.
I was going to say it's very tactile and feeling, yeah, rather than conceptual. So that feeling of the wind buffeting the car is a very particular kind of,
yeah,
sensation.
Yeah. It's about movement.
Pardon?
It's about
movement. Yeah. It is very much, the word tactile is good. He's very much like that, Seamus Heaney. Very sort of earthy poet. And so let's go to another one, another powerful poem, this time on a theme perhaps we can all relate to. Elizabeth Bishop, a very distinguished American poet of the last century. It's called One Art. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster, places and names, and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch, and look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster, some realms I own, two rivers, a continent. I miss them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing is not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster. It probably doesn't need me to explain that very much, but it's something we are all familiar with. If anyone's interested, it's a villanelle, that's the pattern of it, a certain pattern of repeating lines. So as I was saying as well, it's not only that, literal poets who write poetry for me, prose writers are great artists too. And their work goes to the same places as poetry. For example, any exposure to George Eliot, the 19th century English novelist, will show you what good prose is. And we've got another passage. Here's a passage from what some people think is the greatest English novel ever written, Middlemarch. Virginia Woolf said it was the only English novel written for adults. So this is, you should have this one. This is from the beginning of chapter 27 of Middlemarch. An eminent philosopher among my friends, who can dignify even your ugly furniture by lifting it into the serene light of science, has shown me this pregnant little fact. Your pier glass, or extensive surface of polished steel made to be rubbed by a housemaid, will be minutely and multitudinously scratched in all directions. But place now against it a lighted candle as a centre of illumination, and lo, the scratches will seem to arrange themselves in a fine series of concentric circles round that little sun. It is demonstrable that the scratches are going everywhere impartially, and it is only your candle which produces the flattering illusion of a concentric arrangement, its light falling with an exclusive optical selection. These things are a parable. The scratches are events, and the candle is the egoism of any person. And when I first read that, I was quite amazed, actually, that she's got this perfect image, I think, of what it's, in a way, what it's like to be a human being. You think everything is about you, but it's not, obviously. The universe goes on. It hasn't got you at its centre, but that's what we think. And I think it's a beautiful image. It kind of implies what the world could be like if we didn't see it in this egocentric way. It would be a vast, beautiful mirror. So I don't know what you think. Did anyone like that piece?
Yeah.
George Eliot. So in these the examples we've looked at, we could say, we could call that the wisdom side of poetry. I mean, I'm making this up as I go along. But we could call it the wisdom side of poetry. The compassion side can be seen, you could say, in longer poems and dramas like Shakespeare's that explore character. One of the great things about Shakespeare is that he never condemns a character. He presents all his main characters as well and as fully and with equal sympathy as each other. Just as heroes like Hamlet, Othello and Henry IV have depth and vitality and a sort of real existence and gain our understanding and sympathy, empathy, so do even ostensibly evil characters like Macbeth, Iago and Richard III. You're probably familiar with this. You watch a Shakespeare play, you're fascinated by Macbeth. You're with him, really, even though he's a murderer. And this is Shakespeare's compassion to me. The opening up of one's mind and heart to all other beings without condemnation, without bias. Shakespeare has been described as having a great soul, and he allows us for the duration of his plays to take part in his great soul. And there are novelists too who have this love for their characters, superficially good or bad. Characters, I mean, not novelists. Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Henry James, George Eliot and Vladimir Nabokov, they explore their characters, they present them in a very, very deep and vivid way, so that you almost feel you know them as people, whatever their kind of their traits, whatever their ethics, and you understand them. You feel that these novelists truly open the human heart and see it whole, with all its frailties and even sometimes wickedness, and see it and present it with forgiveness, with understanding and love. But there are shorter poems too, of course, that reflect that bigger sky, as it were, of compassion. Now, I recently came across a tremendous poem by the Russian poet Yevgeny Yevtushenko. So that's our next one. People. No people are uninteresting. Their fate is like the chronicle of planets. Nothing in them is not particular, and planet is dissimilar from planet. And if a man lived in obscurity, making his friends in that obscurity, obscurity is not uninteresting. To each, his world is private, and in that world, one excellent minute, and in that world, one tragic minute. These are private. Any man who dies, there dies with him his first snow and kiss and fight. It goes with him. There are left books and bridges and painted canvas and machinery whose fate is to survive. But what has gone is also not nothing. By the rule of the game, something has gone. Not people die, but worlds die in them. Whom we knew as faulty, the earth's creatures, of whom essentially what did we know? Brother of a brother, friend of friends, lover of lover, who knew our fathers in everything, in nothing. They perish, they cannot be brought back. The secret worlds are not regenerated. And every time, again and again, I make my lament against destruction. So, I hope I've given you some idea of how poetry and the spiritual life join up. And what we'll do now is, we've got a little bit of time, and perhaps we'll look at a few more poems that are in this little handout I've given around. And just read them together, and then, not all of them, obviously, just one or two, and then there's time for questions, hopefully, as well, just a few minutes of questions.